Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. You've heard our guest today many times on this program. Sean O'Connell is a movie critic who shares his views with us several times a year. He's also the managing editor of Cinema Blend and co-host of their Real Blend podcast. And he is the author of three books focusing on his favorite topic, films. His latest takes a deep dive into the contributions of actor Bruce Willis. In fact, that's the main title of Sean's latest book, Bruce Willis, Celebrating the Cinematic Legacy of an Unbreakable Hollywood Icon. Writing books is becoming a large part of Sean O'Connell's life and a large part of his contribution to the culture. And so we invited him to talk about this latest effort, why he wrote it, and we'll sneak in some quick takes on this summer movies too and what's happening in the world of Hollywood as well. Sean O'Connell, welcome back. Good to see you, man.
It is always good to be here, Mike. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. You've written books in the past about Spider-Man. You wrote a book about something most people didn't know anything about, and that was you were pleading for the release of the director's cut of Justice League. By the way, has it ever happened? Have they released it?
Oh, yeah. It came out like right as the book was hitting, so I take full credit for that.
Okay. You've written tons of columns on the Marvel comic universe and DC comic films, and now you've moved beyond those things and into something very different. But of all the actors in all the gin joints in all the world, why Bruce Willis?
Well, for a couple different reasons. He's always been a favorite of mine, and whenever film critics get asked, what's your favorite movie of all time, which we inevitably get asked, you come up with a standard answer. And mine has always been the first Die Hard. It's a perfect movie for me. It's a movie I saw at a very seminal point in my life. You know, it's kind of the movie that opened the doors to like, oh, this is an exciting world. And I want to learn more about how films are made. And so Bruce was at the forefront of that. But like, I enjoyed him in Moonlighting as watching that as I was growing up. And then I just sort of charted his career. And I thought he took some really interesting directions over the course of his career. He could have very easily just been a lazy action hero and just done that boilerplate type stuff. But he challenged himself by going with different directors and took big swings and sometimes missed, but often had huge hits. And it was when he announced his retirement recently due to his condition with aphasia that it really hit me. And I thought, like, we're losing something here. We're losing a type of actor that I don't think the industry has anymore. Someone whose name you could put above the title and people are going to show up for that person. And so I wanted to focus on his cinematic output and his career and the type of arc that he took and why it mattered and what we're losing when he retires.
So, whenever I do these things with you, I come at these with my own background and my own prejudices and my own experiences. And so when I saw that you had written a book about Bruce Willis and you called him an unbreakable Hollywood icon, my immediate thought went, yeah, but I know him from Moonlighting. Yeah, I saw Die Hard and I saw Sixth Sense and a couple of other of his films, but I really know him from Moonlighting, which for me was... it was a terrific television show back in the day, and he was great on it. But you say he is a Hollywood icon, and I don't think of him that way. What am I missing here? Why do you?
Because he was one of the few actors. I would lump him in with, like, you might call this sacrilege, but I almost think he's a bit of a Paul Newman, a bit of a Harrison Ford.
Wow.
He's a bankable star. Not just action star, but a bankable star. People followed him to... quote unquote independent films like Pulp Fiction, you know, of which he was part of. And people often forget that he was. Like, Quentin Tarantino gets a lot of publicity for that, the John Travolta comeback, Sam Jackson. But Bruce was a big part of that movie. The Sixth Sense was a behemoth when it came out. Like, that was an enormous film. And I think in large part because of his contributions. Like, Haley Joel Osment gets a lot of credit for giving a tremendous child performance. But Bruce was amazing in that film. He went down the science fiction route in the 90s when a lot of those action stars were doing it. But I think he challenged himself by going with more interesting filmmakers like Luc Besson to do The Fifth Element or Terry Gilliam to do 12 Monkeys. He would give young filmmakers like Rian Johnson a chance to make the type of movie that they wanted to make, and they ended up with Looper. You know, now Rian Johnson's doing things like Poker Face and Breaking Bad and is a celebrated actor. But when Bruce took a shot at him, he was still a young guy. Quentin Tarantino was really kind of not a name when Bruce, you know, lent his talents to Pulp Fiction. And Quentin says, like, I couldn't have made this movie the way I made it if I didn't have the support of someone like Bruce Willis, who guaranteed you an opening weekend. So I think a lot of people are like you. They overlook a lot of the choices that Bruce made, a lot of the movies that he's in. When you remind them of the films that he's in, they're like, oh yeah, he was in a lot of really great stuff.
Well, I went back yesterday and watched a lot of clips from his movies in hopes that I could pull some audio and play some of those clips as we talked about some of his films. And what I noticed three things off the bat. First of all, he didn't talk a lot in these movies. There's not a lot of dialogue from him. It's a lot of action, a lot of walking and doing things and shooting guns and stuff like that. And when he does talk, he curses up a blue streak, so we can't play those clips on the radio.
Right.
But the one thing that stuck out to me is that he had whatever it is, he has it. There's something about him that is absolutely, when you look at it, when you're looking for it, it's magnetic. Can you define that? What is that?
I can't define it, but I've seen it in multiple celebrities over the years that I've been able to meet and sort of, you know, interview and spend time with. And I got to meet Bruce very briefly. He's one of those, he's my white whale. I never really got a chance to interview him because he hated press. He notoriously did not like doing interviews. I think it's a lot of because of the treatment that he and Demi Moore got. When you remember when they were first married, they were like the Planet Hollywood couple. They fueled celebrity tabloids forever. And so I think he came to distrust press for a long period of time. But one time at the Toronto International Film Festival, we were covering Looper, and I was about to walk into a room to interview Emily Blunt, who at the time was not Emily Blunt. She was still just a young up-and-comer. And Bruce came down the hallway of the hotel that we were in, and he wanted to just poke his head into the room and say hello. And Mike, I don't get starstruck. I've met plenty of these people. They don't faze me. They're normal people. But this was like seeing a legend in front of you. You know, like he cut a path through this crowd and just had, like you say, this it. It's a factor that when they're there, you can't help but look at them. And what's funny about Bruce is that he definitely has that. And he definitely was an A-lister, and he definitely had this magnitude to him. But what was his selling point is this blue collar Jersey, you know, Philly relatability. When he was coming up, he was the guy who you think you could sit at the bar with and just, you know, have a couple of beers and trade stories. And he had that relatability. That's what made John McClane, you know, the action hero that he was. He wasn't Schwarzenegger. He wasn't Stallone. He was a regular guy who you just believed could be someone you knew. And he rode that train for a long time as a celebrity.
And I think that came from his life experience. You write about John Goodman talking about sitting in a bar before he was an actor and before either of them were successful actors. And Bruce was the bartender, and he claims that he could look at Bruce as the bartender and know he would be a great actor because of the way he interacted with people at the bar.
Yeah, he was in the New York theater community and as most of them do, tended bar. In order to make ends meet. And the movie Cocktail that Tom Cruise ended up starring in with the bottle twirling and all that stuff was based on the bar that Bruce worked in. And apparently it was a show. You know, you sat down there to be entertained by the bartenders as much as you did to get a drink that night. And Bruce was apparently the star of that show. So, you know, some of these people, it's inevitable. The industry is going to find them eventually and get the right project for them. And for Bruce, it was Moonlighting.
So his was the Japanese steakhouse of bars. Your book, Bruce Willis, is 241 pages long without the footnotes, of which there are pages and pages of footnotes. And I understand that you went back and you watched all 115 Bruce Willis movies. Wow. How long did that take you?
Close to 2 years. It was about 2 years of research. I wanted to, but a big part of the reason why I thought Bruce would be a good person to celebrate too is because with the announcement of the retirement, I could talk about his complete filmography. There wasn't going to be, you know, another couple of years where he might have done some more stuff, and then it would have been, so I could at least do the totality of his work. And what's fascinating about his career is that in the back half of it, he ends up doing a lot of these direct-to-DVD films where he's very clearly, you know, on a set for 2 or 3 days. They shoot everything they need from him. They sprinkle it through the movie. And then he's like a glorified cameo. And I wanted to sort of research, like, are those movies even watchable? Is there anything there to salvage? There isn't. Spoiler alert. It's really a fading end of his career. But I wanted to, again, sort of trace the decisions that he made at specific points with the industry, why things worked, why they didn't work, and really look at them in the big picture of this is what Hollywood was going through. This is why these worked. This is why they didn't work. With the advent of streaming, you know, Bruce was never somebody who went over that way. He did try theater once. He did Misery on stage with Laurie Metcalf. It was a disaster. Because like you said, he's not a monologuist. You know, he lives in these quiet spaces where his sort of granite physique carries the story through, and he lets other people shine around him. And that works in specific projects. And I think he had to find those.
115 films, 241 pages. You could have simply done a review of each film and filled this book chapter by chapter. And that's kind of, you didn't exactly do that, but every chapter in the book is named after one of the films that he participated in. How would you describe how you laid this out? In other words, as a person who has a peripheral connection to Bruce Willis, because I've seen him, take me through how this works, this book.
Yeah, I didn't want it to be a dry biography. Like, this is when he was a child, then he went to this school. I don't find those reads to be interesting. This book is very much structured to be picked up and put down often. Like, I want people to read a chapter and then go watch that movie, you know, or watch something first. Then, because I assume if you pick it up, you're going to flip right to the chapter of a movie that you love. Oh, I love Pulp Fiction. I'm going to go read that chapter really fast. So what I did was I broke his career up into different genres. He did comedies, things like The Whole Nine Yards. He did a cameo in Ocean's 12. He did Blind Date very early on with John Larroquette. I broke it up into science fiction. I broke it up into some of the auteurs that he worked with. Wes Anderson, he did Moonrise Kingdom with him. Sin City with Robert Rodriguez. Of course, Pulp Fiction and The Sixth Sense. I broke it up into, and then of course the last section is just the Die Hard franchise, which I think that alone is an interesting study because of course he comes out the gate with the first one. It's enormous. They immediately crank out a sequel. They essentially announce the sequel before they even have a script. Not a surprise in Hollywood, but that becomes a franchise that he can keep returning to after he's had a couple of duds, right? Oh, it's time to roll out John McClane again because I took a few dramatic swings. The audience didn't connect. And so I'm going to go back to the well, essentially. But he can only do that so many times because by the fifth one, fans of the franchise don't even acknowledge that the fifth one exists. Like we just pretend that like he never made it and it's going to go away. So, but that deserves, and of course, you know, within the Die Hard franchise, there's all these debates. Is the first one a Christmas movie? You know, that always gets discussed. Which one is better, Die Hard 2 or Die Hard 3? There's some people who saw Die Hard 3 before the first movie and they like that one better. It had the chemistry of him and Sam Jackson together. It was, you know, in New York as opposed to L.A. It's all these different factors. So I try to break down all that stuff.
So if this book, and you have said that you view this book as a companion piece to his films, if that is how this works, how should we use it? Should we read the chapter, watch the film, or watch the film and read the chapter? What does reading the book do for our perception of Bruce Willis?
I would almost love for people to read the book, to watch the movies first and then go back in, because legitimately in each of the different chapters, I tried to write specifically about scenes that moved me or points that I want to bring out. And so unless the movie is kind of fresh in your brain, you know, or if you just know it up and down, you'll probably appreciate it better if you take the time to sort of watch the film first and then go back in and read it. But it could be, it works in either direction. And it also, you can read it from start to finish if you want to, or you can just skip around to the movies that you enjoy.
Sean O'Connell is the managing editor of Cinema Blend, which is an online compendium of all things film. He does a lot of junkets now where he interviews the stars and prepares these pieces on the movies. He's also the host of their Real Blend podcast, and we're talking about his latest book, Bruce Willis, Celebrating the Cinematic Legacy of an Unbreakable Hollywood Icon. We'll continue in just a second. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Sean O'Connell, movie critic extraordinaire, is with us this morning. His new book is called Bruce Willis, celebrating the cinematic legacy of an unbreakable Hollywood icon. As a child of the 20th century, Sean, somebody born in the 19s, I have lost the ability to count the decades because of the switch to 20 when we hit the 21st century. So sure. It surprised me that you talk about Bruce Willis having a career that spans five decades. I have no concept of that until I sit down and actually do the math.
Sure.
And you are a movie critic who makes a living watching films and critiquing them from an expert's point of view, not from a social media point of view, or everybody's opinion is equally good. You actually know what you're talking about because you've made a career out of it. And you quote Willis in your book as saying, "I don't believe that anything that gets said about films when they come out really has any meaning or longevity. It's only 10 or so years down the road, 10 or 15 years down the road, that you look back and you say, this film really holds up." Mm-hmm. He's critiquing what you do. So is he right?
Yeah. No, I agree with that sentiment 100%. And in fact, like, there are people who joke that the Academy Awards should be handed out 10 years later. Mm-hmm. And that we would see which films stand the test of time and not which film benefited from the best campaign, you know, for the few months leading up to the awarding of the telecast. Because a lot of these films, when they come out, they're treated a certain way. Now, so for film criticism, you could write it. There's certain ways you can write film criticism. Should I go see this movie this weekend? Like, that's a review. Yes. Yes, you should take the time to spend the money and go see it. Or, you know, I'm going to write and put this movie into a context so that this review stands the test of time. And you can read it no matter when you want to read it. And it'll comment on the film no matter what the film is.
The Pauline Kael approach. The Pauline
Kael
approach.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. You're writing about the film out of the vacuum of the publicity machine, the marketing machine, and all the right. factors that play into it right now. Christopher Nolan's Tenet, when that played in theaters, you know, a few years back, it was during the pandemic. But if somebody finds that movie later on, are they going to think of it differently? Are they going to there's so many reviews of Tenet that were like, we shouldn't be going back to the theater right now to watch something like this. But that's not a review of the film. That's a review of the time period. And that movie might have gotten slammed by some people who didn't think that we deserved to go back to the movies at that time. That's not a critique of the film.
So you don't write, you don't take the time, nobody takes the time in their life, I would think, to write a book because about something they don't like or they're not interested in because it takes a substantial amount of your life to create these things, these books. So when you obviously had an opinion of Bruce and his work. You have written about it contemporaneously in reviews. So when you went back and you looked again at all 115 movies and you compare them to what you said about them originally and what you're thinking now, has your thinking changed?
Tremendously. And in fact, one of the most stressful points about this book is that at the end of it, I do a capsule review of every single film, you know, that mm-hmm. I rewatched each movie and then I immediately wrote a capsule review. Okay. And committing that to the page is stressful because your opinion should change about certain movies. You know, now like some of his, like, I'm not going to change my opinion on Pulp Fiction. I'm going to feel a certain way. But those movies that are like 2.5 stars, you know, you could sway in one direction or the other, or something about them could move you in a different way. It's the same movie, but your opinion changes a little bit over them. There are movies like he's in a movie called The Kid, where he gets visited by his childhood, the childhood version of himself. And when I watched that, I was like, this is just, you know, trash. This is like pandering to families and really lazy filmmaking. And the kid who is in it, I hate to slam a child performer, but I thought he was a terrible performer. When I went back and revisited it, I was like, oh, there's a lot of sweet stuff happening here. You know, Bruce is trying to play the family game, which he doesn't do often. You're right. Like, most of this stuff is violent and R-rated, and the language is tough. And when he tried a family movie like The Kid, it just rubbed me the wrong way the first time I watched it. But going back and seeing it again, I was like, all right, no, I more appreciate this.
How much of that is because you are older and because you are a father?
100%. I mean, I always say films don't change, but you do. You know, mm-hmm. so when you go back and rewatch a movie that played a certain way when you were a certain age, and then you go back and revisit it, you're a different person. And that's what I find that to be so frustrating for filmmakers, because, you know, here's the audience responding with what they're bringing to the picture. And so that I understand why filmmakers say you just have to make the movie the way that you want to make it. It has to be true to you, and how the audience is going to respond is then up to them. But it's kind of out of your hands once that happens.
But there are these classic films like Casablanca and The African Queen that mm-hmm. meant something very different to the people who saw them when they were first released in the theater to how we see them today with a distance of 50, 60, 70 years. They're still mm-hmm. great movies, but they mean something different. You keep saying in interviews, and you've said it this morning, that to you, Bruce Willis seems to be the last of the dying concept of A-list movie stars, who you could put on a marquee and people will go see the movie just because they're in it. Mm-hmm. But what about George Clooney or Sean Penn or Robert De Niro or Leonardo DiCaprio? What about them?
There's still a few. I don't think Clooney's that guy anymore.
Really?
If you go back over his last few movies, The Boys in the Boat, you know, something like that, went right to Amazon. You know, George can't get a movie into theaters anymore. Harrison Ford, the great Harrison Ford, mm-hmm. his last few movies, he went back to the Indiana Jones well, and he's going to appear in a Marvel movie in February. It's getting tougher and tougher to get, you know, original films made by actors who put their weight behind a project.
Well, what does that say about the movies? Is it because of what Hollywood has done? Have the movies done it to themselves? And maybe they did it deliberately, because if you have a star in a picture, you got to pay him a boatload of money. But if you just have a machine like a Marvel movie where you have stock characters who are in these stock situations where things get blown up and it's all dependent on special effects, you don't have to pay these people as much. Have they done it to themselves?
100%. And the audience has sort of dictated this is what we turn out for. Vince Vaughn, the actor Vince Vaughn, was giving an interview recently, and he had a run where he did a ton of original comedies. You know, you might not have liked them, but like Old School, Wedding Crashers, these are original ideas that he and Owen Wilson were in. Then he talked about the fact that for a long time, the Hollywood only wanted IP. So we got Battleship as a movie, you know, as a movie, and obviously the Marvel brand and the DC brand and people like, and this is why we keep seeing Ghostbusters movies that come back around. And this is why this in a few weeks, we're going to see Alien Romulus. It's like,
but is
you
this,
have to it, have.
We're going to talk about this later in the program, but is this why I used to look forward to summer and Christmas, because that's when all the great movies were going to come out and I might spend my summer in the cool air conditioned theater loving these films. And now I don't even think about going. Is that why? Have they diminished the movies in some way where television is better, more compelling, more accessible? Who needs to go to a theater?
Well, it's just different, Mike. From way back when we started talking like this, the audience has changed. How are you getting a younger audience into theaters? I don't know if the younger audience is responding to actors anymore. Leo might be that last, you know, age group where people are going to see one of his movies. But even still, what does Leonardo DiCaprio do outside of Scorsese team ups? And God bless him, I would do Scorsese movies all the time if I were invited to do them as an actor. But you don't see him necessarily branching out and doing, you know, work on his own, because it's, again, really tough to do it. Because what is luring the younger audience back in? Well, who's coming in behind us and watching this stuff? I'm not trying to slander the younger audience, but they have a shorter attention span that wants to see things on a timeline that's zipping through. They don't necessarily sit down for two-hour movies.
Right. They want to see it on TikTok. You told Zach Dennis in the Charlotte Observer when he interviewed you about this new book that you appreciated the risks that Willis took as an actor and the way he pushed himself to work with really talented filmmakers. How did he push himself, and how was he allowed to do all these different genres that he ended up doing? Because a lot of actors get pigeonholed.
Yeah, well, he resisted becoming just John McClane, the diehard character over the years, but again, fell back to the action genre whenever he needed to. So let's take The Bonfire of the Vanities as an example, which is, again, another movie that people forget that Bruce was even in. It's a disaster, you know, by all accounts. That's a legendary Hollywood bomb. But when you think about it on paper, it makes the most sense. It's the adaptation of an incredibly popular Tom Wolfe novel at the time. It's a Brian De Palma film, so you have to assume you're putting your hands into a trusted director. It's got Tom Hanks and Melanie Griffith in it. If you told me that movie was going to bomb, I wouldn't believe you. Now, you go back and rewatch it, and De Palma's the wrong choice for it, right? The tone is just not in his wheelhouse. So he tries to make it into his type of movie, and it's not, it doesn't fit the subject material. But at least Bruce tried. You know, Bruce at that point could have easily coasted on. I go back to the Planet Hollywood guys, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone, who he has lumped in often. The three of them sort of launched the Planet Hollywood franchise. Stallone was doing Rocky 3 and 4 and 5, and, you know, he just was riding that coattail, whereas Bruce was doing something like Mortal Thoughts, where it's not a great movie, but he plays a despicable character in it. He plays an abusive husband who gets suspected of murder. He'll go over and do something like The Color of Night, which is a sleazy sort of made-for-cable movie, but at least he's trying something different. And when those movies kind of fail, then he retreats right back to the action genre, and he does something like The Last Boy Scout, which is right in his wheelhouse. He could just safely get up and hit a double, and the audience is going to love him in the part. And then he'll go back out and do something like Nobody's Fool, because he's going to get some scenes with Paul Newman. You know, like he has these opportunities. Directors want to work with him. He knows if he puts his weight behind a script, the projects are going to get made. And sometimes he knocks it out of the park with like The Sixth Sense. And sometimes he does something quote unquote lazy like Armageddon, but it's still a blockbuster. So, and I don't think you see that anymore.
But even in, as I was watching these clips yesterday of all these different films and all these different genres, whether he's just the silent guy angry and he's going to shoot you in a second, or he's being a nice guy to a little boy. There is this humanness that comes through, and I think that may be part of the it factor that he had.
I think so too. And I there's something special about him that I kind of realized is that he was comfortable in ensembles. And he didn't have to be the center of attention. He was happy to let other people around him shine. So in The Sixth Sense, he's able to set up Haley Joel Osment. He's able to set up Toni Collette. One of his, you know, funniest parts was that cameo he does in Ocean's 12, where it's a convoluted bit where Julia Roberts is pretending to play Tess, her character, who looks like Julia Roberts. And then Bruce sees her in a hotel and they have to play off of each other. And it's incredibly funny because Bruce is able to drop his guard and make fun of himself and let other people shine. So he's a movie star who was comfortable letting other people around him do their best work. And I think that that's very rare.
You mentioned Haley Joel Osment. This is one of my favorite films. I don't know why. I can't explain it. Yeah. We're talking about the M. Night Shyamalan's The Sixth Sense, a movie that sticks with me to this day.
I see dead.
Anything. Are you sure they're there?
Sometimes you feel it inside, like you're falling down real fast. You ever feel the prickly things on the back of your neck?
Yes.
That's them. They get mad. It gets cold.
How often do you see them?
All the time. They're everywhere.
He's great in that movie. And so is, of course, so is Haley Joel Osment. But Shyamalan was an unknown director when Bruce Willis came to this picture. And I guess he came to it for the reason that you said. You get opening weekend box office if you get Bruce Willis in your film. But why did he choose to help that director?
This is what I heard from several filmmakers who I got a chance to speak to, who Bruce worked with at an early stage of their career. If he believed in the script, if he believed in the story, he wanted that person to adhere to their vision, whether it was M. Night Shyamalan, whether it was Quentin for Pulp Fiction, whether it was Rian Johnson for Looper or Luc Besson for The Fifth Element. And what Bruce would do is run studio interference. He would say to them, I'm putting my faith in this person. Let them tell the story the way that they want to tell it. Because most people get the films hacked up through test screenings and executives who weigh in and want to see more of this and less of that kind of thing. And Bruce had a nose for scripts that he thought were going to work. And he was right more often than not. So M. Night Shyamalan has said in multiple interviews, The Sixth Sense would not have turned out the way that it did if Bruce wasn't able to stand up for me, a filmmaker who had no clout whatsoever, and say, no, let the kid make the movie that we've seen in the script. This is going to work. And then it works. Not always, but often.
Of course, the other motivation is there. That is the fact that this he was the first actor to earn more than $100 million from a movie as a result of doing this back in 1999 because he got a piece of the action on this film, and it was remarkably successful. He came, as I've said, to public consciousness, our collective consciousness, when he appeared, God, was it the 80s or 90s?
80s, mid-80s.
In the 80s, on ABC's Moonlighting with Sybil Shepherd.
David, you are awful.
Don't you, David, me, you wanton woman.
Wanton what?
Wanton woman. That's what I called you because that's what you are, a wanton woman. A woman who's wanton. Don't deny it. I know what I'm talking about. I called your house every 15 minutes last night.
You did?
Yes, I did.
That is so sweet.
Get your mitts off me, you Scarlet Pimpernel.
Scarlet what?
I guess I have to bear a lot of the guilt for this. I'm the guy that drove you to it, working with me, side by side, day in, day out. It's bound to make a weak-willed woman like yourself a little crazy.
David.
We're both mature adults here. I understand the problem, and I'm willing to help solve it.
As I watched like 15 or 20 clips of Moonlighting yesterday. That was a TV show way ahead of its time in terms of its sexual allusions. It lasted 5 seasons, and when he started it, he was already 30. What had he been doing up to that point? Because that's the first time we ever heard of him.
No, again, tending bar, doing some theater, and waiting for his opportunity. So let's go back to that time. That there were a lot of TV stars breaking into the films from, you know, going from TV to film. Tom Hanks was on Bosom Buddies. He goes into Splash and Bachelor Party. Saturday Night Live at that time was cranking out, you know, movie stars. Eddie Murphy, Dan Aykroyd, Belushi, Bill Murray, all these guys. And that's the path that Bruce Willis took. He got a hit television show that fit him like a glove. They immediately tried him in Blind Date. So this blows my mind. Kevin Smith, the director who worked with Bruce on a couple different things, said that Bruce's counterpart at that time wasn't like a Harrison Ford or a Richard Gere. It was probably Bill Murray. He had the wild, tousled hair. He had the rapid-fire dialogue. And he did a sort of what-if scenario. Like, what if Bruce Willis had gotten the Ghostbusters part instead of Die Hard? It might have put him on a trajectory to just do comedies. Like, maybe he would have just been the comedic guy, you know, for the rest of his career and never had the action swing. It was only when he did Die Hard that the industry saw him that way and sort of pushed him in that direction. I think it would have been a completely different career, and it would have been sort of fascinating to see if he could have played that, because Moonlighting proves he had the comedic timing. He could have done that material.
And he was the unknown. She was the known. This was a vehicle for Sybil Shepherd, Moonlighting. How long did it take for everybody to realize, including Sybil Shepherd, and I have 20 seconds, that this was his show, not hers?
Oh, immediately. The earliest reviews say this isn't a show without this actor. So and he took it right away.
What did that dynamic do to their relationship on set?
Oh, fractured it, as you'd imagine. it wasn't great.
We're talking about Bruce Willis and his time as an actor with Sean O'Connell. His new book is called Bruce Willis, celebrating the cinematic legacy of an unbreakable Hollywood icon. We're coming right back with more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Sean O'Connell is with us, author of Bruce Willis, celebrating the cinematic legacy of an unbreakable Hollywood icon. He's also the managing editor of Cinema Blend and co-host of their Real Blend podcast. He's a longtime film critic who knows what he's talking about. Let's talk about Moonlighting just one more time here, because it was, I remember not wanting to ever miss. This is back in the days when you didn't have DVRs and you didn't have VCRs, for that matter. You saw it or you missed it. And I remember making sure that I was home when Moonlighting was on, or at a friend's house who wanted to watch Moonlighting, because it was just that much fun. And it was just fun. She wasn't very good in it, but the two of them together were terrific.
Well, do you remember that there was like a big will they or won't they on a couple of shows? Cheers thrived on, you know, Sam and Diane, essentially. And Moonlighting thrived on Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd, are they ever going to romantically get together? And, you know, people who sort of track the show religiously say that it fell off once they finally did. But I think that episode is one of the highest rated in the show's history. And that kind of overwhelmed what the show was doing. The show was really clever in terms of spoofing genres, you know, in each individual episode. The clip that you played was from a one that was like completely done in Shakespearean tone. You know, like the dialogue was completely from a Shakespearean play. They've done 1940s film noir, you know, riffs. And it was like the number of pages in a Moonlighting screenplay was double what a normal show was, because the rapid fire dialogue was unprecedented on TV at that time.
Well, it's very much a throwback to My Girl Friday and some of those 1940s films where it was just like that. Everything was so snappy, which made it compelling to watch. Is this your third book in
it
4 years?
These
books have come out back to back, and they're not just knockoff books where you just sit down at the typewriter and whip them out over the weekend. There's a lot of research involved in all of the books that you have written. This seems intense, perhaps insane.
It was a mistake. Yeah, it was a tremendous mistake. And
why?
One that I won't continue. For some reason, I needed something to distract me. I needed, extra work. I liked these ideas. I really liked the idea of tinkering on a book. You know, I really liked the idea of doing the extra research. I was engaged by the process. Now I understand how much work goes into them, and not just going into them, but like promoting them after the fact. It's so weird in my industry. You think of like the opening weekend, and then once the opening weekend happens, the project is gone and you move on to the next thing. And maybe that was part of how I'm wired mentally, is like you immediately start thinking, what's the next thing? What's the next thing?
Yeah.
But books have long shelf lives. You know, I'm now that I have three of them out there, I hear from people who are just learning about the first one, you know, and I'm like, but I didn't spend enough time pushing that. I didn't spend enough time talking about Spider-Man. You know, that one got swallowed up by Bruce Willis. And so it's great to be continuing to expand your readership. And I'm going to ride the coattails of these books for a little while. But you mentioned it earlier. You have to have an idea that you love, because you're going to live in this world for 2 years, at least 2 to 3 years. And I finished the Bruce Willis book 18 months ago, you know, and the publishing cycle is just, that's how long it takes for the publisher to ramp up when they're going to release. You know, they know their calendar a year in advance. So you often sit and wait. And so it has to be a subject matter that's still relevant, you know, and not timely. I'm used to writing for the web. The web is this, you know, you write it, you put it out. It's you move on to the next thing. Books are a different animal.
Publishing strikes me very much like filmmaking. These actors make these movies, and it takes a year or two for them to be edited, and then they put them on the release calendar, and sometimes that gets moved by a year or two, and so they're out there promoting movies that they did 4 years ago and they don't even remember doing.
Yeah, exactly.
You started writing movie reviews locally here in Charlotte.
Yes.
Then you moved to Cinema Blend as a contributing writer, and now you're the managing editor of Cinema Blend, and you've built this national reputation for yourself. You're right up there with Siskel and Ebert just about now, and you've written these books, giving you more exposure. You were recently interviewed by Forbes for this book, Bruce Willis' book. Would all of this have happened if you had planned it? Did you plan it, or did this just happen to you over time?
It happened over time, and you have to stay flexible because the industry changes, the industry of how film criticism works. You know, if you had told me X amount of years ago that I'd be doing a podcast, I wouldn't even know what it is. But you have to keep your ear to the ground of how people are consuming their content and then shift to it. I do a lot of stuff on camera, you know, for our YouTube channel. That seems completely foreign to me as somebody who started writing. But I'm comfortable on camera. I don't mind getting up and just talking briefly. You know, today, this morning we got up and my wife was like, hey, you're going to be on the radio today. And then tonight you have a book signing and you're going to get to talk in front of all the people. Are you nervous? Are you excited? You know, because she wouldn't do that. But to me, that just comes, it's second nature. I love getting up and just talking about film. And so even the podcast is something where it's like, I just wanted to do something with two of my friends where we turn the microphones on and we just, you know, BS about movies. And if people want to listen to it, great. They tend to enjoy it. But you have to shift at the way that people, like, you can't keep cramming newspaper reviews down people's throats if people don't read them. You have to change your approach, and you have to stay fluid and keep dancing on it. So I can't say I planned anything, but I think I stayed pretty flexible and was able to stay in the industry that way.
You told one interviewer, I read a lot of your interviews yesterday, that you find it difficult to enjoy movies. I suppose that's because watching a movie is a job for you. but I looked over a partial list of summer films, and I thought, either I've never heard of any of these or I don't care. So is that part of why you feel it's sometimes difficult for you to watch a movie and enjoy it?
Sure, it's work. You know, there's no way to avoid the fact that I've made something that I love, movies, into a job. And that's the incredible benefit, but sometimes can be a chore. When Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes rolls around, you have the ability to look at that and say, well, I'm never going to watch that movie ever. I don't have to sit down and watch that. And I'll think, well, that's 2 hours and 20 minutes on a Tuesday night that I'm going to have to sit through.
And you're never going to get back.
And you're never going to get it back. And then you have to process some way to break it down and talk about it. So, you have to stay up to speed with everything that's going on. If you're going to talk intelligently about the film industry, you have to keep up to speed with everything that's coming out, the things that are working, the things that aren't working. You can't pick and choose. I think you have to be as much of a completist as you can, which is daunting because, I mean, then there's international films and documentaries, and you have to sort of pick a lane. And at Cinema Blend, we cover most of the mainstream stuff. So if I want to find something that's enjoyable, I'll either go back to a really, really old film and just be able to watch it and not have to think critically about it. Or we watched Endless Love on vacation, the 1981 Brooke Shields movie. My wife turned it on. It was on Netflix. That's an awful film, by the way. It's really bad. But it was great to be able to sit there and just kind of laugh at it and enjoy it and not have to think about it too much. So that's what I do to sort of distract myself.
So you sent us a list of movies that are out this summer on screen, most of which have already opened. I don't know how many of them are waiting to be released, but are there any must-sees on this list, in your opinion?
There's not necessarily.
Now there's the comment.
This speaks to exactly why, what, you know, here are the movies that are big right now. Planet of the Apes, Quiet Place Day One, Despicable Me 4, Deadpool and Wolverine, the new Marvel movie. You're not going to see those movies because of who's in them. You probably couldn't even tell me who's in them. You're going to see them because they are the franchise that Hollywood has told you is important. Now, I love the Marvel movies. I would highly recommend Deadpool and Wolverine to people who love superhero movies. But general audiences can't go to it. They're not going to enjoy it. You can go to Twisters, and some people might know Glenn Powell, who's become really popular lately, and that has a mainstream, you know, appeal to. It's just an action movie, but it's a remake. It's a remake of a movie we've seen before.
Every single movie you've mentioned is either a remake or is a sequel to or a prequel to a franchise we already know about. What's up with that? I mean, have we just run out of ideas?
The industry is risk averse. They do not want to take a chance on a movie because they become too expensive to make, too expensive to market, and you have to create something that's going to at least be familiar to people. Instead, I'm going to send everybody to the Independent Picture House where they are screening. They have a movie called Didi that's opening on Friday from Focus Features. Fantastic, fantastic human drama, character driven. You can still find these movies. They are still out there. I promise you. You're just not going to find them in the multiplexes anymore. The multiplexes have become the business is too. It's teetering on a point, Mike. We've been seeing it happen for years upon years upon years. The best things I'm going to tell you as a film critic is Presumed Innocent, the Jake Gyllenhaal show that's on Apple TV Plus. You know, it's longer form storytelling on television, and that's where the actors are going, and that's where the best writers are going, and the theaters are filled with IP. Well,
part of this is certainly because of the shifting technology, which drives shifting tastes and vice versa. But part of it's also the industry doing it to itself, just as radio did it to itself. Right? Who listens to radio anymore, aside from public radio? Why would you listen when you have Sirius XM and you have Pandora? Why would you listen to less talk, more music on an FM station? You wouldn't. And I saw this coming 30 years ago, and no one would listen to me. So anyway, let's talk about some of these films. Deadpool and Wolverine, getting a lot of buzz because of Ryan Reynolds and Hugh Jackman, another film from the Marvel Universe. And the verdict is?
Well, I really liked it a lot, but I'm a sucker for these movies. I'm in the tank for Marvel films. So I get it if it's not appealing to everybody. What blows my mind is Hugh Jackman at 55 years old is continuing to play this Wolverine character, and he looks like he's 30. But what I also am fascinated in is I know you're a musical theater guy, and Hugh Jackman has that whole side to him.
Like, he's terrific.
He could do that for the rest of his career, but he still puts himself through the physical grind of prepping for a superhero movie. And I can't
Wait a minute. It's either that, where you knock this movie out in 2 months and it's physically demanding, or you do 8 shows a week in New York for a lot less money. What would you do? What's your choice?
Okay, that's fair enough. I need a lot of chicken breasts and bulk up and play Wolverine for a couple of months. But he's terrific in it. He's a great actor. I love him in it.
Then there's Twisters that you've already mentioned, which is I thought they were just running the old movie back, but no, this is Twisters, not Twister. This is a new version of it. How is it different? I mean, they're just people chasing tornadoes, right?
It's not different. It's slightly different characterizations, but it's the same movie. But you know, you put the S on it, you pluralize it, which means the danger is double. And you're going to pay twice as much to see it. So it's fine. It's perfectly fine. The visual effects are better, but like, you know what you're getting out of that movie.
Then there's The Quiet Place. This is a John Krasinski franchise. He's the guy from The Office. And he did the first film. And then there was a second film. And I think this is the third
film? This is the third and the first one that he didn't direct.
And it's a prequel because this is A Quiet Place Day One.
So this is a really popular franchise, and it's because they're figuring out ways to explore the story moving forward. And I don't know if they planned this or not, but the first Quiet Place began on day somewhere in the 100s. It was like 110 or 115 or something like that, where humanity has had to figure out how to stay quiet because these aliens that are invading respond to noise. Now with this prequel, they're taking you back to day one. And not only are they taking you to day one, which is the day of the invasion, but they're dropping you in the middle of New York City. So the question is like, what if you had to be quiet in the noisiest place on the planet? Clever hook. I thought it really worked well. Lupita Nyong'o is the star of it. You might not know that she's the lead in it, but she's terrific and is a big part of the reason why the movie is as good as it is. And as long as they keep finding new ways to explore the world, you know, in this Quiet Place universe, I think they can make a few more movies out of this. But we'll see. There were 11 Police Academy movies, so who knows?
John Krasinski may not have directed this day. What's it called?
Quiet Place. Yeah.
But he's still working this summer because he wrote, produced, and directed If, Invisible Friend, which includes, again, Ryan Reynolds with the other cast of live actors, plus the voices of people like Steve Carell and Louis Gossett Jr., Matt Damon, Bill Hader, John Krasinski himself, even John Stewart. Brad Pitt is also credited as Keith, an invisible friend, even though the character has no dialogue.
No dialogue whatsoever.
So what did Brad Pitt do?
Collected a check. Got some residuals, I guess. You know, I really wanted to like If. It's a sweet concept. It's, you know, all these imaginary friends, essentially, when kids grow tired of them, they are lost and need to figure out what to do with the rest of their existence. It has no story beyond that, unfortunately. Krasinski probably should have stayed in the Quiet Place universe. It was a cute idea. The execution was a little bit lacking.
You just spoke with M. Night Shyamalan, who also directed that Bruce Willis movie that we talked about, Sixth Sense. His new one is called Trap. And you wanted to talk about this. What did you think?
I did. It's such a stupid movie, but I had so much fun with it. It's one of those ones where, Josh Hartnett plays a serial killer. This is known from the trailer. He's been terrorizing Philadelphia, and the police figure out that he's going to be at a concert because he's taking his daughter to the show. So the concert is a trap. And once he gets into the concert, he's got to figure out how to think his way out of the show where the walls are closing in on him. But every twist is inconceivable. Like, I mean, M. Night writes himself into a million corners. But I just stopped nitpicking it. I just went for the ride, and Josh Hartnett ended up being really entertaining, and I had a good time with it. So if you can sort of, I hate to say this, turn your brain off and enjoy yourself at a summer fun movie, this is the one to go to. Trap is a good time.
I have about a minute left, and I want to go back to Bruce Willis, because that's what your book is about. And you wrote it in part because he retired from the film business, because suddenly and without any notice in March of 2022, Demi Moore put a post up on social media saying that he was retiring from the film because he was experiencing some health issues, diagnosed with aphasia, which is impacting his cognitive abilities. That's a terrible thing. There is no cure for it. Where is he in that horrible long road?
Towards the end, from what I understand, and he's getting the best care possible. Obviously, he's surrounded by loved ones. His new wife, post Demi Moore, is Emma Heming. She's doing an incredible job of keeping people up to date on his status. But from what I understand, he lost the ability to communicate. Had realized while working on scripts that he couldn't memorize things anymore. He couldn't retain dialogue. And I think it's a slow, steady march to the end, and I hate it. It's heartbreaking for him.
And you can see it in the last movie he did, Out of Death. You can actually see an example of what you're talking about. Bruce Willis, celebrating the cinematic legacy of an unbreakable Hollywood icon, the latest book in the pantheon of books written by our guest today, Sean O'Connell from Cinema Blend. Sean, thanks very much.
Thank you, Mike.
We go out with the theme to Moonlighting.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.